morning and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C. Nigeria's president-elect Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu finalizes preparations in Europe for his upcoming May 29 installation.
Bola Ahmed Tinubu is not yet the president of Nigeria. He has not been sworn in officially by the provisions of the Nigerian constitution. He's as free like any other person to attend to sundry issues.
Ethiopia Airlines, seen as Africa's fastest growing airline, inaugurates the second phase of its Skylight Hotel.
Ethiopian Airlines is following a 15-year strategy, and a core component of that strategy is to develop the airline as a group.
And Zambia's main opposition Patriotic Front condemns the withdrawal of police officers from the residence of former President Edgar Lungu.
Clearly from their attempt to raid his home last week to now completely slipping off of all security is a direct calculated scheme to make him vulnerable so that they can do whatever they would want to do.
Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigeria's president-elect Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu is in Europe to finalize preparations for his upcoming swearing-in on May 29th. In a statement, his aide says Tinubu's working visit to Europe includes meeting with investors as well as use the opportunity of the trip to fine-tune the transition plans and programs and his policy options with some of his key aides without unnecessary pressures and distractions. This trip comes shortly after the president-elect's return on April 24th after a two-week vacation in Europe. It also comes as the election tribunal hears a legal challenge of the disputed outcome of the February 25th presidential election. For the latest political development and the case before the tribunal, I reach attorney Samuel Ihezekian.
Imanta is his private life. Bola Ahmed Tinubu, also known as Tiwaju, and some people refer to him as the Jagaba, is entitled to the right to privacy. He has his own freedom of fundamental human rights, and he has his own right to keep himself of any ailment he has. But it doesn't affect his ability and his status to become a president and to lead Nigeria. So the issue as to what is happening to him, I don't think for now, Nigeria should be more interested in what they can get from Mr. Tiwaju's governor. And also to, in line with the pending court cases, election matters, they should also be concerned to know the outcome and not what the current state of Tiwaju's health is all about. So I don't think he's held business for now. Is there anything to raise concern? However, I see all the shadow cabinet and these cases, we should also be open to Nigeria. If we have many health challenges, we should be objective enough to let Nigerians know so that we can, eventually, whether in prayers or communication, we can assist in this process.
Online, there have been memes, and some are stating that the outgoing president, Muhammadu Buhari, is in Europe seeking medical attention, and their incoming president, the president-elect, is also in Europe, who recently went supposedly on a two-week vacation, which some people said it was due to, receiving medical attention. So they said, where did Nigeria go wrong?
It's quite appalling, saddening, and so unfortunate that at this stage of our lives as Nigerians, what we are talking about is the issue that has to do with lack of business healthcare, the presence of business healthcare in Nigeria, and facilities to cover and to cater for all manner of illness and diseases that that affect the people and even our political leaders. It's quite very, very unfortunate. So the issue of the president is the allegations are actually true. Going abroad to seek medical solutions to whatever ailment he has, I would say it is not palatable. It's not a good one. So because the present government, they have just 2 weeks to go, and it's of no use actually throwing the baby and the water when the football match has ended. Our focus should be on the new government that is coming in and what they intend to do to basically and immediately transform mortality rates, provision of basic healthcare facilities, transformation of all healthcare services, improvement in the service of NHIS, and see how healthcare all over Nigeria, go to the grassroots level, how it can be transformed. It's quite very unfortunate that for over treatment as easy as malaria, some politicians are still going abroad.
So we're talking about the National Assembly. There is a suggestion that there has to be perhaps a law or a measure that will compel these politicians or public office holders to seek medical attention in the country, to be prevented from using public resources to seek medical attention abroad. What is your take on that?
I support the call. Matter of fact, I think I'll be interested in the process. I think I will liaise with some of my friends at the outside the National Assembly of the Civil Society so that a draft of the bill can be sent to, we can pressurize the National Assembly to present that law, because we are tired. Things cannot continue the way they are in Nigeria. Yes, I support the call, I clamor for it, and wholeheartedly, free of charge, I don't mind drafting a bill to the National Assembly. So that a law should be sent to the National Assembly, who will consider it at every stage, that a mandatory law should be put into effect, that every politician should find a way to take healthcare as one of his constituency projects, and they should focus more on healthcare facilities all over Nigeria.
Those in the National Assembly are the direct beneficiary of seeking medical attention abroad. Will they come up with law against themselves?
You know, Stephanie, there have been some, one thing we've been able to achieve, we from the civil society, we've been able to engage the National Assembly, and that is why you see there's a new law as regards electoral reforms in Nigeria, the new electoral act. I think that the synergy will be employed into this issue as to healthcare facility. I know some of them are beneficiary, but there's a way we'll put pressure on them. They can actually see how this can be addressed.
Attorney Samuel Ihezekian is a political analyst. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Ethiopia Airlines, seen as Africa's fastest growing airline, has inaugurated the second phase of its Skylight Hotel. With more than 1,000 rooms and 5-star facilities, officials say the hotel is the biggest in Africa. It also incorporates meeting and event facilities, which can accommodate from small numbers to up to 5,000 guests. Located in a prime area about 5 minutes walk from Addis Ababa Bole International Airport, the hotel, officials say, is a suitable space for both business and social gatherings. This after the airline company announced it has also just received its 20th A350 aircraft from Airbus. The officials say the hotel and the growing routes of the airline career, as well as a boost in tourism, are all part of a strategic plan to become a leading global player. For the latest development and why Ethiopia Airlines has become a successful African story, I reach Mesfin Bekele via Skype. He is the chief executive officer of Ethiopia Airlines. Here is part one of the conversation.
Ethiopian Airlines is following a 15-year strategy, and a core component of that strategy is to develop the airline as a group of interrelated business units that are related to the air transport industry. This hotel contributes in three ways. The first goal is to accommodate transit passengers passing through the Addis Ababa airport who will lay over in Addis Ababa for a day or two. The second, to generate additional revenue to the group by providing hospitality service to customers. And the third one is it will help in developing tourism.
What makes your organization a positive African story? In other words, how did you achieve this?
One of the key enablers of our success, number one, to have a vision and a long-term strategic roadmap, and our development of internal competency to successfully implement this long-term strategic roadmap. In addition to that, the African air transport industry was badly affected during the COVID period. When COVID became pandemic in March of 2020, nearly all airlines stopped flying. They grounded their aircraft, they stopped flying. Some of them laid off their employees. But this was not what Ethiopian Airlines followed. Instead, Ethiopian Airlines identified two opportunities amid those challenging times. The first one was cargo. Instead of grounding our airplanes, we continued operating to transport cargo, focusing on medical supplies, like the personal protective equipment. And that was followed by test kits, which was again followed by the requirement to transport vaccines. So we focused on cargo operation and generated enough money that kept us to continue without downsizing and instead expanding in some way.
Talking about your long-term goals, I read reports that your organization has achieved a strategic plan of 2025 way ahead of time. What was the plan? And what steps did you take to actualize it that made you to revise it to a new 15-year plan?
Yeah. In our Vision 2025 strategic plan, we set a goal of becoming the leading airline in Africa by 2025. Because when we developed this strategy in 2010, there were a few airlines who were bigger than Ethiopian Airlines and operating at a bigger volume. So our goal was to become the leading airline in Africa, and we achieved it before several years. We became the leading airline, the largest airline in Africa, at least before 5 years. We had other goals as well. For example, in our Vision 2025, we set a goal of flying to 92 international destinations. But now, before we reach 2025, we are flying to 131 international destinations. Our fleet plan indicated that we would reach, in terms of number of aircraft, 112 by 2025, but already we are operating 140 aircraft, even now. In terms of passenger, the goal was to achieve 17 million passengers, but in 2019, we reached 13 million, and we would have exceeded the target much earlier than 2025, but COVID dragged us during the last 3 years, and this year we have just fully recovered to 2019. We have two more years before we reach 2025, and we expect to achieve Vision 2025 figure in terms of the number of passengers we carry.
Mesfin Bekele is the Chief Executive Officer of Ethiopia Airlines. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation.
Has social media improved your life? Or is it more of a distraction? We'd love to hear from you. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code plus one, then 202-258-3076. The number again, plus one, 202-258-3076. Can't wait to hear from you.
In Zambia, the main opposition Patriotic Front, or PF, has condemned what it says is the withdrawal of police officers from the residence of former President Edgar Lungu. It comes after the police service issued a directive demanding the withdrawal of some police officers from its protection detail, a move the police say is meant to redistribute excess police officers. But the opposition party says the move is meant to intimidate the former president by making him vulnerable to attack. Last week, the police attempted to break down the main gate of the former president to carry out a warrant following a dispute between the former first lady and an individual on the property. Rafael Nakachinda is a member of the PF Central Committee for Information and Publicity. He explains to me why he disagrees with the withdrawal of the police officers protecting Lungu.
To suggest that the police have reassigned some officers, that is the crap that the police are trying to present to the public. The former president is accorded the opportunity to choose those officers, whether it is the administrative secretary and the other staff in his office, including his security, because there are issues of trust that are supposed to also be guaranteed when it comes to the people serving the office of president in sensitive areas of that nature. It happened whether it was Kaunda and others. But with what this government has done is that clearly from their attempt to raid his home last week to now completely stripping off of all security is a direct calculated scheme to make him vulnerable so that they can do whatever they would want to do.
The police are saying that accusations by the Patriotic Front that they are stripping the former president of all security detail is not true, and that there were excesses and they were just reassigning these police officers. How do you respond to that?
You see, Mr. Peter, a leader ultimately produces his own kind. The issue we have is that it is the government at a time through the office of secretary to the cabinet who are responsible over the welfare of the former head of state that identified the residence or the house where they accommodated or they accommodate the former president. And one of the issues that were raised at a time is that since the identification of that residence was hurriedly done, the location of the residency, it's an insecure area. Hence, the government decided they needed to beef up security because of that particular area. The question is, has the security situation in that area improved? The answer is no. But also, that position has been validated in the sense that a few months ago, the former head of state's residence was broken into. But as it were, they actually responded by even adding two other officers to say the area is polar and therefore the former head of state needed more security. It was not on the basis that maybe the former president is desiring to have a battalion of officers to guarantee security. But I think the practice is, even if it wasn't the former head of state, if my life is in danger as a citizen, I am accorded, for example, security of two officers. If it is determined that two officers are not adequate, they will still deploy more. And in this case, the security of the president, the former president, has been compromised from the day he went there, and therefore the officers that were there were required. And it is still, the circumstances have not changed up to today.
What is the party going to do about this after expressing concern? What's the next line of action
for
the
party? Deployed our own party security. Our young people have offered themselves to go and secure the state vigil at the residence of the former president. But the state is now threatening to arrest those youths for unlawful assembly. Yesterday, they sent a battalion of police to go and arrest youths who went basically just to make sure that the life of the former president is not threatened.
But isn't the deployment of personal security to the former president by the party basically creating an illegality?
If the state abrogates that that responsibility and state agencies become now a source of threat to the life of the former head of state, what do you expect the citizens to do? What do you expect his supporters to do? What do you expect his colleagues and those that have worked with him to do, to just stand and watch? That we will not do. We will, if it means even laying our lives for a comrade, we will do it. We're going to continue to stand with him. We'll provide security, even if it is just human shield, to make sure that he is protected.
Rafael Nakachinda is a member of the PAF Central Committee for Information and Publicity. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Meanwhile, Zambia's police deny accusations that the reassignment of police officers from former President Edgar Lungu's detail is an effort to intimidate him. The denial comes after the police sent a letter to reassign officers who are part of his protection detail. The police say the officers are needed for other duties. But the main opposition Patriotic Front calls the explanation propaganda. They say the withdrawal of the police comes after they recently attempt to break down the main gate of the residence of the former president to carry out a search warrant. This, the opposition party says, is an apparent use of state institutions to intimidate and harass Lungu. For more on the decision, I reach the police spokesperson, Danny Mwale.
What we have just done is, you see, the former head of state, the former head of state in Zambia, even the past head of state, they are entitled to state security. And there's a certain number. There's a number which is attached to the office of the former head of state. Not only this past former head of state, the 60th president of Zambia, no. But it's in black and white. The former head of state is entitled to state security. And what we have just done is that we have withdrawn the excess manpower. We have withdrawn the excess police officers who were attached to the 60th president of Zambia. These officers, we had called them even last year, but because of one or two reasons, we could not have them back. Our own reasons, we could not have them back. So now we thought that we should have them and be reassigned to other duties. So in short, the former head of state still has state security with him. What we have just done is we have withdrawn the excess manpower. He is entitled to state security. For example, if he's entitled
Danny, are you saying that the police administration made a mistake by giving him excess protection in the first place?
No, we never made a mistake. It was not a mistake at all. No.
Okay.
It was not a mistake. You know, we are a security wing, and we never made any mistake. No. We never made any mistake. What we have just done is we have just recalled officers. We have just recalled the excess staff which was attached to the office of the former head of state.
Some people are saying that the optics doesn't look good, especially when the police recently tried to enforce a warrant about a dispute between the former first lady and then there was an attempted effort to grind the gate or break the gate and all that. The politics associated with it doesn't look good. How do you respond to such concerns?
Yes, we agree as Zambia police that people are free to misunderstand our actions. Yes, we agree. We are not denying that. No, we are agreeing that that people can raise and misunderstand the action that has been taken. But everything is being done in good faith. You see, we haven't kicked everyone out. No. You still remain with what you are entitled to. Yes, if you are entitled to 5, we can't allow that you have 15. We can't allow that you have 10, for example. Yes, so people were going to be up and complaining if we said everyone completely is out. No. Up to now, as we are saying, there is state security. Yesterday, there was state security. Tomorrow, there will be state security. But what we have just done is the entitlement that is supposed to be accorded to. That's what we have done. That's the step we have taken.
So, Danny, what do you say to those who are saying that the police action basically makes the government look bad because they will use this as a political tool to make the government unpopular, although the decision was made by the police administration? How do you respond to them?
Like I said, people will interpret it in one way or the other. But the truth is, the head of state, the former head of state, still has police security. If we get what does not belong from you, how should we stand up and complain? You see, what we are saying is he still has state security. Even now, we have just left you with what you deserve. We have just left you with according to your entitlement. So we haven't deprived you of anything more. We haven't deprived the former head of state of anything. No, he still has state security, even today.
Danny Mwale is a spokesperson for the Zambian police. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. In Namibia, a human rights defender says it is illegal and an affront to the constitution to impose a ban on the recruitment of citizens with visible tattoos by prison authorities. Phil Yanangol also says it is unacceptable for prison authorities to discriminate against those with tattoos. His remarks come after Raphael Hamunyela, the Commissioner General of Namibia Correctional Service, says it is not appropriate for employees to wear visible tattoos. He also adds that the organization will review its recruitment policies and code of conduct to bar candidates with the markings from joining the organization. Observers say society frowns upon people with tattoos because it is assumed they belong to criminal gangs, an assumption Nangolo sharply rejects. He tells me that there is no law that makes it illegal for citizens to have ink markings or symbols on their skin.
As a human rights group, we are, of course, very disturbed because that violates the rights of people to get employed. And the reason being given is tattoos, it's really irrelevant. It does not mean that somebody who's got tattoo is a criminal or whatever. So it's something really that is totally, totally irrelevant. And I believe many Namibians will condemn it as we are doing right now.
Phil, do you see this being taken to court about this ban? And since this is a parastatal, do you think the legal challenge will succeed?
Yes, it will really succeed on the basis of discrimination. Yeah, on at least social status. Yeah, but, members of our society are so much cowed into submission in most respect by the authorities, so such that they don't want to be seen to be at loggerheads with the authorities. That is the problem. And that is why I doubt if somebody will take the matter to court. And it should really be taken to court.
But do you see any human rights defender or an activist making such a move?
We would do it, but to go to court here, you have to cough up a lot of money in order to hire lawyers and stuff like that. It's extremely expensive. That is one of the biggest problems, preventing people from taking matters of this nature to court.
The Commissioner General for the Namibia Correctional Services, Raphael Hamunyela, said visible tattoos were not a good reflection of the service. You don't think that is legitimate? Why?
No, it cannot be legitimate at all. It goes right to the heart of the Bill of Rights, and specifically to Article 10 of the Namibian Constitution that prevents discrimination on inter alia on social status.
Well, some people are saying that the prison needs to protect its image and that Namibians are overall very conservative people. Society frowns on people who wear tattoos or who have tattoos on them because they look like criminals or in gangs and such. Why do you think this is improper?
It is improper because another point, and that is a very important point, governments, any governments, got no image to, I mean, they cannot be defended against, they cannot be defamed. No government can be defamed. No politicians who is operating as a politician can be defamed. And that is the point. So, as I said, it is irrelevant, totally ridiculous that my good friend Rafael Hamniela can come up with that ridiculous pronouncement, which violates the right of people really to employment and to not to be discriminated against.
Now, Phil, some people are calling for a reversal of this decision, saying that it is not good and that people have their fundamental rights to do what they want as long as they are not breaking the law. And having tattoos is not breaking the law. Do you side with that assertion that this should be reversed? And do you see it being reversed?
Yeah, it will probably be reversed if people express outrage. But if they are quiet, then certainly it's not going to be reversed. But it's not a crime. There is no law in Namibia. I don't see it anywhere in the world that prevents people from having tattoos. There is no such a law. And you cannot criminalize, which is effectively what it means, criminalize something in terms of a law which doesn't exist.
Phil Yatnangolo is a human rights defender and leader of the NGO called NAMRIGHT. He spoke with me from the Namibian capital, Windhoek. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, while there has been limited progress in ceasefire talks in Sudan, the conflict could depend on the role external actors who can either worsen or ease the situation. Neighboring nations are divided on their support for Sudan's armed forces and their rival rapid support forces, as are some of the major world powers. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, explained to my colleague Mohammed El Shenawi what role major external factors have in the conflict.
External actors are trying to establish a ceasefire, create a pause in the fighting, which can open up some humanitarian corridors. In the process of doing so, the hope is that this will create some confidence-building steps that then each side can build on to begin to bargain in good faith. Now, to move this along, each of the regional international actors who are involved and who are focused on stabilizing Sudan, they need to convey to the military actors in Sudan, General Burhan and General Hemeti, that there isn't a viable military solution. You know, even if one side were to win a military victory, they face the same challenges that the military government faced before. You know, there's a lack of legitimacy, deep popular resentment, a collapsing economy, need for massive investment. All of these things are what drove Omar al-Bashir out of office in 2019, and they've only gotten worse. So international actors need to be conveying those messages to the two rival generals currently and to help incentivize them to move toward a negotiated outcome. Now, time matters because the longer this goes, the more likely that two sides are going to see a fragmentation of their forces, and then it will become a battle of militias, and it's going to be a lot harder to control and come to some sort of negotiated settlement. And in the same way, we see that external actors have their own interest, and the longer that this goes, the more likely they are to intervene and try to secure an outcome that works for them. And so I think that's part of the challenge, that international actors aren't in consensus on Sudan. Many would be happy to see a military government continue. Many of the Gulf actors are afraid that if a democratic government were to take root in Sudan, it would put pressure on themselves. And so, you know, they have alternative visions. Others are looking at taking advantage of the situation in Sudan and creating some sort of vassal state arrangement through a proxy. And in the process, Sudan would lose a high degree of its sovereignty, as well as face ongoing instabilities. And so trying to find a solution for this conflict quickly is a high priority. And, you know, this brings us back to the role of civilian actors. Civilian actors represent the vast majority of Sudanese. You know, they have been highly organized for years, leading up to the protests in 2019, calling for a democratic transition. And they continue to do so. They have put forward their own path for a way forward. And civilian government, ironically, that offers the best prospects for a stable and sovereign Sudan. And, you know, it may be that a civilian government is the outcome that each of the rival generals can most palatably accept if they themselves can't come out on top of this. And so I think it's important to keep the civilians in mind and make sure they have a seat at the table.
Former Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok has issued a warning that the conflict may escalate to levels even more dire than those seen in Syria and Libya. Could the Sudan conflict become the region's next worst crisis?
I think it very easily could be. You know, there are so many external actors with interest in Sudan that there is very strong incentives for them to get involved. And to the extent that Sudan becomes a regionalized conflict, it becomes many times more complicated and difficult to bring it to resolution. And, you know, these external actors, as we've seen in Yemen or Libya, you know, they have ability to pour resources into the conflict without bearing significant cost in terms of human lives, disruptions, infrastructural devastation. And so, you know, they can prolong that conflict and exacerbate it much more deeply and for a longer period of time than the Sudanese actors would themselves. And I think the other element of that is if and when one external actor becomes involved, we're going to see others jump in to try to counter their influence. And that could lead to quite a prolonged and very devastating conflict in Sudan.
Joseph Siegel is Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He spoke with my colleague Mohammed El Shinawi.
If you are in Sudan witnessing events taking place there, or if you have family you are talking to there, you can call us on WhatsApp and let us know how things are going there. Dial the international code plus one, then 202-258-3076. The number again, the international code plus one, then 202-258-3076.
A new project aims to reopen the official border crossings between Kenya, Somalia, and Ethiopia, which have been partially or fully closed in recent years due to security issues. The project, supported by the British government, is designed to spur cooperation and economic growth. For VOA, Ahmed Hussein reports from Wajir County, Kenya.
Speaking Thursday in the border town of Mandera during the launch, Kenya's Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua said the project will improve socio-economic developments between the three countries.
Infrastructural development is silenced by armed conflicts. We must silence the gun for the industries to roar back. We must silence the violence for socio-economic prosperity.
The UK-funded initiative dubbed Deriswanag in Somali, which translates to good neighborliness, aims to find a lasting solution to the perennial insecurity and instability in the Horn of African nations. Even though various border crossing points have been officially closed at times over the last decade, militants, criminals and regular migrants still cross borders with little problem. Last year, the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab sent hundreds of fighters into Ethiopia before being pushed back by the regional forces. British High Commissioner to Kenya, Jane Marriott, says the project is a strategic investment for Kenya and the Horn of Africa region.
You have numerous challenges together: drought, resource conflicts, armed proliferation, terrorism. But you also have so much that is good and positive together, and it is that that we want this program to help bring on.
Gachagua assured that the government will implement measures to eradicate conflict, such as improving road and water infrastructure networks, as well as enhancing education. They said they will tackle the root cause of terrorism through intelligence and putting greater manpower on the border to catch Al-Shabaab insurgents. Kenya closed its official border post with Somalia in 2012 to hinder Al-Shabaab's movements. The border closures included the Mandera border post as well as Lamu, Wajir and Garissa border crossings. However, earlier this year, Kenya announced it is reopening its border with Somalia and Ethiopia. Somalia Minister for Security Mohamed Ahmed Sheikh says the project is timely and will effectively tackle cross-border insecurity challenges.
And in that spirit of collective solidarity, there has never been a better time to forge a common destiny and collectively participate in this project to tackle cross-border challenges.
The project launch happened a day after security compact was signed between Kenya and the United Kingdom on Wednesday. Ahmed Hussein for VOA News, Wajir, Kenya.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Oh, your friends about VOA Africa. Music, sports, and news.
Success will never come to you.
No.
But I can do what you gotta do.
Do what you got to do. Yeah.
Nobody really cares.
Nobody
Success
cares.
Will never come to you.
No.
But I can do what you gotta do.
Do what you got to do. Yeah.
Nobody really cares.
One God.
DJ Kamuka tell him.
Zimbabwe Ghana.
Ability yeah. Extension.
So you don't fear to fall in love, but I go fight till the day I go call you mine. Ah, all day, been coming, baby, in sweetie, in jolly, been coming, lady. Ah, oh my baby, you're a queen, compliment me as a king. Get the boys, mama, go baby. G
tie bi e bene wo ma kune mu for you because me do wa baby is deep oh we siri e mu na me kune happiness yeah me bo wo di when you be a metro eh a day we can say memra
Bar from Pretoria in South Africa, and you are listening to Nightline Africa from the Voice of America with Peter Cloete. Stay tuned and don't change the dial.
Was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Mike Hove, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a presumed fool who sleeps in his father's house is not a fool. I'm your host, Peter Cloete, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa. Thank you.